And then Jeremy's on Skype. Jeremy, are you there?
Mr. Barksdale, can you hear us?
Maybe we lost him.
He may have muted it.
For a moment.
Show me there. Jeremy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All right, we're going to get started. They've got to approve your participation in the meeting, so just hold on one moment. Are we ready? I will. So the mics are on.
Good evening. I want to call to order this meeting of the Planning Commission for July 12, 2017. My name is John Davidos. I serve as the chair. This evening, we have all commissioners present, with the exception of Commissioner Lang, who's on vacation and is excused. So before we move to approve the agenda, I believe we will have to make a...
Yes. If I could, Chair Davidos, Terry Cohen with the Planning Commission staff. We have Commissioner Jeremy Barksdale, who is joining us by Skype. He's at a conference in Washington, D.C. Your bylaws are silent as to how to deal with remote participation, but in lieu of that, the clerk's office has advised us to follow what City Council's process is, and that is that it has to be approved ahead of time, and they found it satisfactory. Should the Planning Commission allow Mr. Barksdale to participate remotely, it could be done if you took a motion to that effect at the beginning of the meeting, and if approved, then Commissioner Barksdale could join you as the fifth member around the table.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Cullen. Do we have a...
Yeah, I thought you could do that up to four times a year.
Do the...
Attend a committee or a commission meeting remotely.
Four times a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something in the bylaws.
Oh, those are the new bylaws that we're looking at, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The existing ones don't have mention anything about participating.
Okay. So do we have a motion? Yes.
Do we have a second?
I move we welcome Commissioner Barksdale's attendance via Skype.
Excellent. All second. In favor say aye.
Thank you.
Aye.
So the motion passes, I believe, then we are...
All right. Welcome, Mr. Barksdale. Let the record reflect. You are officially part of the meeting tonight.
Thank you.
So, moving on then, the first item is the approval of the agenda. Do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We have the agenda approved. The first item is the City Council communications. I believe we will hold off until we have the mayor present. Any community council presentations this evening? I'm gathering not, so I'll give it to you, Mr. Cullen, then.
All right. Thank you, Chair Davidos. From the staff's side of things, we are a final meeting before you go on summer break, and the final meeting for the current officers is going to be 2 weeks tonight on July the 26th. I'm asking every commissioner to commit to coming that night. We'll have a little celebration of sorts, but also I want to get pictures. I like to do that at least once a year, get the commission together to take pictures and kind of reflect where we've been over the past year before we go out on break. So I'm going to put that out there. Also, I think you all are aware that the Assistant Director at Planning and Community Development, Dan Stroh, is leaving the City of Bellevue. After 28 years, it is with some sadness that we are saying goodbye to him. And he is embarking on an exciting journey, and wish him all the best. He will be with us through till I think next Monday or Tuesday. But I'd like to ask him to come to the mic for a few moments, please, and to address the Planning Commission. I've only known Dan for a year and a half since I've started, but with his tenure year, he has seen so many changes and has been instrumental in seeing and effectuating so much of the change that makes Bellevue so wonderful today. And just incredible contributions, and he's been a wonderful mentor. And from staff to boss, I want to wish you well and say thank you.
Well, thank you, Terry, and thank you, commissioners, for allowing me to spend a moment reflecting on my time here with you. It's been a real privilege to serve the city in this capacity. My title has been planning director since 1998, so it's been a number of years of being in this role, and it's been a real privilege to head up our long-range planning function in planning community development and our neighborhood outreach group. There have been many, many initiatives that the city has worked through during this time, and it's really through the combined efforts of the staff, the Planning Commission, the public, and our council that we've been able to achieve some amazing things in this community. It's wonderful to see the progression. Bellevue is always moving forward. This is really an amazing community, and as I travel in other parts of the world in the coming period, I know I'll be making some comparisons to the incredible quality of life, the sustainability, the people of this community. So again, it's been a tremendous privilege to serve in this role. It's very bittersweet to be moving on, and I'll be continuing to take a tremendous interest in what is happening in Bellevue as this community continues to move forward, and I know in some great directions. And again, I want to thank you for the time you give in this role as planning commissioners. It's a volunteer role. It's incredibly important. The partnership between the Planning Commission and the staff is part of what makes Bellevue able to achieve some of the great things we're able to achieve. So thank you for the time you put and the energy and diligence you put into the work that you do. It's incredibly important. So my last day with the city will be July 18th, but as I said, I'll be continuing to look on with great interest at how Bellevue continues to progress. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And we have a small token.
Just a second.
So thank you. Thank you. I want to just, maybe before I give this to you, just a few seconds. I've really come to know you over the last...
Good. I've really come to know you over the last 12 months.
In my role as chair. And there is one thing I do want to emphasize loud and clear, which is... when Dan does something, he does something 200%. He puts heart and soul into whatever he does. And that to me was a reflection of not just yourself, but also staff and the city of Bellevue. Now, we may have not seen eye to eye on every single topic along the way, but the fact that whatever you did completely to the utmost of your ability, I fully respect and I appreciate it. I want to say thank you. Thank you. Just a small token from us to give you.
Thank you. This is from us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dan. All right.
Did the mic work?
Yes, it did.
All right. And Dan, please send us pictures along the way. Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
So, public comment. I believe we actually have no public.
There's comment. No public.
This is a first.
There's no public
first
to comment.
5 months, something
are
like
your
that.
Ratings going down?
We must be losing our star power. All right. So, the first topic is the study session. So, we'll give it to you, Mr. Cullen, back again.
Thank you very much, Chair Davidos. The next agenda item is titled The Digital Transition. This is a project that has been underway now for a year. It's been a year in the making, and we are very excited about it. What this is we are switching over to more of an electronic format, not more of. We are switching over to an electronic format for all of our packages. And in order to make that happen, you will be receiving tonight tablets, iPads actually. And you're going to get some training tonight on important considerations such as the Open Public or the Open Meetings Act, public records retention. You're going to get a little bit of training on how to use your new iPads, how to access your packet now in the new format. Now, I will tell you that You are going to be leading the way for all the boards and commissions. I've been getting questions now from the Transportation Commission, from Human Services, and they're watching with great interest. Council, as you know, already has this format, and they're using it, and using it with great success. And I think that you're going to really like it. You're going to have enhanced capabilities and being able to look at the work and access it. You will have the comp plan in a highly visual format available at your fingertips that you can quickly go through from page to page. So I'm very excited about that and the possibilities it brings. When we were looking at this, I totaled up the printing costs from the beginning of January of 2016 to the end of October 2016. And the printing costs alone for the Planning Commission's packets and the delivery costs built into it exceeded well over $60,000. So the savings to the taxpayers is going to really add up over time. Eventually, we're going to have a transition period where you're going to be receiving in both electronic and paper format, but eventually when you go completely to the electronic format, this approach using the tablets in the electronic format will pay for all of the equipment within a matter of less than 3 months. And on top of it, just think of the environmental benefits of being able to do this paperless. And you'll have all the functionalities of paper. And it'll be a lot easier and a lot more compact to carry around. But I am not going to get into all of those details. I'm going to stop at this point because I want to acknowledge the interdepartmental team that put this together, because there were many, many meetings and many bridges that had to be crossed. It wasn't just a simple matter of doing this in the private sector of okay, let's get the tablets and let's hand them out and let's start doing it. There's a lot more considerations that have to be put into place, especially when you're dealing with government. And there's a lot of legal considerations that had to be addressed. So I want to thank the staff team that has made this possible. Several of them are here tonight. First and foremost would be Charmaine Arredondo, who's the assistant director in the city clerk's office. And this is Charmaine. I think you all know her. I've also got Matt McFarland, assistant city attorney. And I've got Chris
Jaloki.
Thank you.
Hey, Terry.
I apologize. Yes.
Really quickly, can I call from my phone instead of through the computer? Is that okay?
Call from home? I think we would need to go. We need to get you one of those. I'd have to send you the information and the call-in number. Are you having difficulty hearing us?
Yes. It's just skipping. I can call from my phone. I've got you right here already, ready to call. So I'll just hang up here and then just call.
Okay, but you've got to be able to call a conference line to be able to patch us in.
Or is it coming into Skype?
Are you calling? Would he be coming into Skype?
Yeah, he can do that. He can.
Yeah. Okay. I can see you on Skype. I got City of Bellevue up on here. I can just call. It'll ring on your computer.
Okay. All right.
1 second.
Okay, Jeremy, are you there?
Yep, this is much better. Thank you.
Okay. Did you want video with that or just the voice?
Voice is fine.
Okay.
And some fries.
Thank you.
All right, then. Okay, and Chris Jaloki from our IT department, and Mark Zoker, who is also from our IT department. He is not here tonight. Kristen Gullidge, who is from Planning and Community Development. And we have some folks tonight from the Pacifica Law Group, if you could just raise your hand, and they'll be talking with you tonight, too. And Kathy Ebner, who is from our Public Records. So we've got a host of experts here that have worked together to make this possible tonight. At this point, I'm going to turn the mic over to Charmaine, and she's going to walk us through and introduce the various speakers that we'll be talking to tonight.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Cullen. Chair Davidoff, Vice Chair Walter, Commissioners, we are very happy to be here tonight in doing this digital transition, but a really important component is our training. So I would like to ask Matt Siegel and Jessica Skelton to come to the table. They are going to deliver the Open Public Meetings Act and Public Records Act training that is required of the Commission. So I would excuse myself and ask Mr. Cullen, did you load their presentation onto this computer?
Nope, but I can get it.
It's okay. I have it on mine. I'll just unplug and plug back in.
I think we've done.
While Charmaine is bringing that up.
It's required every 4 years. So this is a refresher training.
Yeah, this is required every 4 years. And actually, if you don't take it tonight, you have to make it up at a future time. It is required of every member that sits on a board and commission. So,
and I will say that our city council did just receive this training about 3 weeks ago, back in June, as a refresher for them as well. So this evening, it was just a good time to bring this back to you because you are getting actual city devices and you are getting city email attached to those devices. So the records retention requirements and all of that, this was a good rollout for the refresher training.
And I have a question.
Before you jump into that, Jeremy, if I could, when you do your presentation, if you could, when you go to the next slide, verbally say that you're going to the next slide so Commissioner Barksdale can follow you. He's got the presentation on his computer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. I also have a separate question.
No.
Okay.
Is it possible to cover the comprehensive plan amendment land use criteria as well as part of this?
No. we could, but the folks in front of you tonight, that's not their specialty. That's not their area of expertise.
Okay.
I mean, that's an entirely different subject matter than what they're presenting.
Okay.
Okay. But we can talk about putting that on a future agenda if you would like.
Okay, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Charmaine and Terry and commissioners. Some of you we did see a few years ago. In addition to the statutory requirements for refreshing the training, there's obviously been a lot of developments in these areas of the law over that time. So for that reason, I think it's also good as a practical matter to revisit some of these things. The good news is that we didn't get on until close to 10 o'clock with the City Council, and we managed to get through our presentation in about a half an hour. Absolutely.
I think you should probably give us
your... Can you please introduce
yourself? Sure, I will. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. So anyway, we will get through this efficiently, but absolutely make sure we have time for questions as well. I think Charmaine mentioned, but I'm Matt Siegel. I'm a partner at Pacifica Law Group. I've been working as an outside lawyer for the City of Bellevue on various projects for about 17 years now. My partner, Jessica Skelton, has been working with the city for about 10 years, is that right? And she and I have done a lot of these trainings, both for the city boards, commissions, and council, and for other jurisdictions on similar issues. So we're happy to be back here tonight, and we're happy to continue providing this resource to the city. We're going to really break this up into two primary sections. The first is going to be the Open Public Meetings Act, which Jessica is going to cover, and then I will come back and cover the Public Records Act. So with that, I will hand it over to Jessica.
Good evening. As Matt said, Jessica Skelton from Pacifica Law Group. And next slide. So I'm going to start with just a really brief overview of what laws apply to the Planning Commission. Next slide. The general governance of the commission is that as a public law body, obviously Washington law applies. And as Matt indicated, we're here tonight to talk about two particular laws, the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act. And to the extent that the commission's bylaws or procedures conflicts with state laws, including these laws, then of course municipal and state law controls the commission's decision making. What other procedures apply to the commission? The commission has adopted bylaws. I know one topic you're going to talk about later tonight is the proposal to update your bylaws. There will be a couple points during the presentation tonight where I'll talk about what your current bylaws provide, but also what's proposed as far as changes. I'm not going to get into detail about those proposed changes, and that I understand will be covered by Charmaine later on this evening. But where rules or procedures are not addressed in the commission's bylaws, then the commission is explicitly governed by the city council's rules, which are adopted in resolution number 8928, and then also Robert's Rules of Order, which is a set of parliamentary rules. They were used here tonight, motions and seconds and all of that good stuff. So those are the procedures and laws that govern your proceedings. Next slide. Did I miss a next slide? You'll have to remind me if I do. We're on to the Open Public Meetings Act. Next slide. So the Open Public Meetings Act is a statutory chapter that applies to essentially all public bodies here in Washington State, including commissions, boards, councils, committees, subcommittees, etc. Next slide. And in 2014, the legislature made a change to the act to impose a training requirement for the Open Public Meetings Act. And that requirement is that every member of a governing body must complete the training within 90 days after the member takes the oath of office or assumes his or her duties. And then additionally, every member must complete the OPMA training at intervals of no more than 4 years. And so this leads to the question of what is a governing body under the Open Public Meetings Act, because a member of a governing body must receive that training. And the definition is set forth in the statutes I've provided, and I'm sorry, I'm on the next slide. It includes multi-member boards, commissions, committees, councils, or other policy or rulemaking bodies, including those that take action on behalf of the governing body and conduct hearings or take testimony or public comment. And so that, of course, means that this set of statutes applies to the Planning Commission because you fall within that definition. Next slide. The basic provisions of the Open Public Meetings Act are pretty straightforward. All meetings have to be open to the public, except if the purpose of the meeting falls within a very explicit and specific statutory exemption for an executive session. And I'll talk about executive sessions in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. There's a couple of required elements for an open meeting. There must be a notice, there must be an agenda, and there must be published meeting materials and minutes. Those things are usually taken care of via staff here at the city for your purposes. And then additionally, meetings where city business is received, discussed, or acted upon must have a quorum of members of the body. And for the commission, a quorum is a majority of members. That's the statutory requirement. Next slide. You have to have an open public meeting where action is taken, and action is defined under the statute very broadly. It includes the transaction of official business, including but not limited to receipt of public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, and final actions, pretty much almost everything that you do. And no legal action can be taken by a body like the commission except if it's taken in a public meeting. That's the most important requirement of the Open Public Meetings Act. Next slide. The quorum requirement under the Open Public Meetings Act is that there isn't a meeting, and the Open Public Meetings Act doesn't apply if there's not a quorum present at a meeting, and that is the Citizens Alliance case from a couple of years ago, 2015. But the converse is also true. If action is taken by a quorum of members of a body outside of a public meeting, that is a violation of the Open Public Meetings Act. And so members of that body should be careful not to take action, whether intentionally or unintentionally, outside of a regularly scheduled public meeting or a properly constituted special meeting. And remember the very broad definition of action that I talked about a few minutes ago. And I'll talk a little bit about some specific circumstances in which a meeting might be convened where you might not expect it. Next slide. The current commission bylaws define a quorum of a majority of members. I believe that that provision will stay the same. One thing I thought I would mention, and I think we talked about this the last time we did this presentation, is that there is a provision under the current bylaws that talks about determining the quorum at the beginning of a meeting, and then that the quorum would stay in effect regardless of whether members might leave the meeting. That's actually not compliant with state law. I know that's something that has been suggested be revised for the new bylaws. So this is one of those situations where, of course, you need to comply with state law and maintain your quorum throughout the meeting in order to take action.
So the meeting can continue, but you can't take action if you lose your quorum?
Right. And so actually that next bullet point talks about the things that you can do without a quorum. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can recess, you can adjourn, you can take steps to determine whether a quorum exists, but you're very limited in what you can do without a quorum. Agendas under the Open Public Meeting Act.
Next slide.
Oh, sorry, next slide. Not used to that, as you can tell. Agendas under the Open Public Meetings Act in 2014, the legislature made a change to mandate the posting of the agenda online. That's statutory, has to be posted at least 24 hours in advance. However, as you likely know, that doesn't invalidate subsequent modifications to the agenda and doesn't invalidate otherwise legal action taken where the agenda was not posted. So it doesn't have a lot of teeth to it, but obviously good practice to make sure that agenda is posted. And then at a special meeting, only action that appears on the posted agenda may be taken. Under your current bylaws, any member can move to amend the proposed agenda, and actually it currently provides that that decision has to be unanimous. I believe that's also a proposed change for the new bylaws, which is to make it a majority, which is more consistent with standard practice on that. Next slide. Executive sessions. This is actually a development under the Open Public Meetings Act for this year. The Washington Supreme Court recently issued a decision, and by recently, literally like 3 weeks ago, that clarified how to interpret the circumstances in which you can conduct an executive session, that is, a deliberation of issues outside of an open public meeting. And as you're probably aware, the statute sets out very specific statutory exemptions from the Open Public Meetings Act. I'm not going to go over all of them, but we've included in the materials here some of the most commonly used justifications for an executive session. So they include things like selecting or considering the acquisition of real estate, or to consider the minimum price of real estate, to review negotiations on the performance of publicly bid contracts, to receive and evaluate complaints or charges against a public officer or employee, but the provision provides that the officer or employee can request that the hearing be public, to evaluate qualifications of an applicant for public employment, or to review the performance of a public employee, but that person can always request that, but the discussion of salary, conditions of employment, and the final hiring or discipline decision has to be taken in an open public meeting. Next slide. To evaluate the qualifications of a candidate for appointment to elective office, to discuss with legal counsel representing the agency matters related to enforcement actions, litigation, and potential litigation. But keep in mind, it's not just because a lawyer is present. It has to be a discussion that falls into one of those categories. And then for other specific statutory purposes that are set out in the statute that I've put there, RCW 4230110. And as of 2017, there was a change to the purposes for an executive session, and now you can also convene one to discuss a data security breach. Before convening an executive session, the presiding officer must publicly announce the purpose for excluding the public and the time the session will be concluded, and the executive session may be extended by announcement of the presiding officer. As I mentioned, next slide. There was a 2017 case, came out June 8th, regarding the purposes for an executive session. We don't get a lot of open public meetings cases, actually, here in Washington. Tons of public records cases, but fewer open public meetings cases. And so in that case, the Washington Supreme Court considered the executive session provision regarding the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease. And the court determined that the plain language limited the discussion in executive session to consideration of the lowest acceptable value to sell or lease property as provided in the specific language of the provision, and unanimously held that executive sessions may not be used to discuss contextual factors such as impacts on jobs, the environment, the quantity of land taken, and property improvements, all things that the court acknowledged were relevant to the price or the value of the lease that was at issue in the case. And so I think what this case has signaled to us is that the court is going to interpret those provisions for executive session very narrowly. So really, when you're convening an executive session, you need to make sure that it falls within the very specific statutory language that provides for an executive session on that topic and limit the deliberation in executive session to those topics. Next slide. Serial meetings. This is an example of a situation in which a meeting might occur when you might not expect it. And so this first came up in the Wood versus Battleground School District case that we've put here. And essentially, a serial meeting is conversations between smaller groups of a public body that put together constitute a quorum. So Commissioner Walter talks to Commissioner Carlson, and then Commissioner Carlson talks to Commissioner Morisot, then suddenly you're going to put together a quorum on an issue that could potentially constitute a serial meeting.
Could you just clarify that? So how does it work? If let's say, again, to use your example, Commissioner Walters has emailed to Commissioner Carlson. That's just the two of them.
Correct.
There is no quorum at that point in time.
Correct.
And so do they forward the email, or is now Commissioner Morisot part of the email discussion? How does it work?
Sure, and I'm going to actually go to the next slide because that'll give you a little bit of additional guidance on that, and then let me know if I haven't answered your question. Because it's still a topic under the Open Public Meetings Act where we haven't had the Washington Supreme Court, so just going back one slide, this was a decision of the Washington Court of Appeals, the intermediary court. So the Washington Supreme Court hasn't fully weighed in on how it's going to treat serial meetings, but they have suggested the following criteria to determine whether, in fact, a meeting occurs. And so that is that the members must intend to meet and transact official business, and the members must communicate about issues that may or will come before the commission for a vote. They have to take action. Remember that very broad definition of action. And in this particular case, a meeting, the court held that a meeting didn't occur where only three of the six council members participated, and then a fourth member just passively received an email about the issue. However, if you're putting together positions and deliberations and discussions that's involving a quorum of your body, you're probably moving beyond what the court held was okay in the Citizens Alliance case and into the realm of having a serial meeting that violates the Open Public Meetings Act. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, sure.
I have a question.
Sure.
So what about, so this is a serial meeting, I presume, means one person talking to another person, then talking to another person, and so forth, until you reach quorum about the same issue. Right? Like some, about the same topic that would come before the commission as a whole for action, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what about if it's, for example, a survey, and it's not around a decision that the body would make regarding something like land use or something like that, right? But it's just feedback around how the meeting went, right? But there's no back and forth, it's one direction. Does that make sense?
So it's kind of a temperature test of how everyone felt the meeting went?
Yes.
I mean, I would say be cautious. You know, I mean, as you can tell, the definition of action is very broad. It's not just votes on issues, it's deliberations. So if someone started expressing, you know, displeasure about an issue that was likely to come up again and multiple other people weighed in, you know, then you're running the risk of violating the Open Public Meetings Act. I think, you know, the less you can have those conversations, I think, you know, the better. Obviously, you're going to talk to each other, you're going to see each other at, you know, social events, you're going to get your picture taken together, all of those things can happen. But, you know, I would say the rule of caution is always the best rule to apply.
Right. Sorry, let me clarify, if I could. So there's no discussion between multiple. So in this case, it's not going from one to another to another. It's like, if it's a survey tool, everyone's responding to one place, like not to any other person specifically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think what gives me pause about that is it sounds almost like a vote. So, you know, obviously it very much depends on the context and what's being asked, but I think anything where you're asking, you know, a quorum of your fellow commissioners to weigh in on something that could fall within that broad definition of action, then you're outside of, you know, then you're in the realm of a potential violation of the Open Public Meetings Act. Does that help?
It does, thanks.
Okay. And we're going on to the next slide at this point. So social media and the Open Public Meetings Act. So, you know, as we saw in the Citizens Alliance case, the Washington Supreme Court determined that there wasn't a serial meeting with the passive receipt by one council member of an email. However, they left open the issue of whether other types of communications using other types of social media would constitute a serial meeting. So keep in mind, you know, one person tweeting to another who's posting on a website and that's getting comments, all of those things run the risk of constituting a serial meeting, and the best practice is to avoid that. Next slide. Violations of the Open Public Meetings Act can result in civil penalties, specifically against members, and fees assessed against the city. Next slide. And in 2016, actually, the legislature increased the penalty provisions. So now the statute provides that a member who attends a meeting where action is taken in violation of the OPMA for the first time, that will lead to liability in the amount of $500. And then after that, the liability is increased to $1,000. Obviously, nobody wants to be fined, but, you know, one of the bigger concerns about Open Public Meetings Act violations, as you're probably aware, is, you know, public trust and confidence and public perception that their business is being taken care of in compliance with the law in an open public forum. Next slide.
Thank God our salaries can cover that.
Well, I know from your new proposed bylaws that that is not true. So, any other questions at this point about the Open Public Meetings Act?
I have a question. It's not related to this body. It's related to a body that I'm aware of. Is that okay to ask it?
Sure. We'll see. Yeah. We can answer it, but why not? Yeah.
We can't help you with the United States Congress.
If people are elected officials and they're at a social gathering, say they're on the council and let's say four of them are in the same neighborhood association, is there any reason that says they can't go to the neighborhood association meetings and do neighborhood functions? Neighborhood, you know, voting on the officers of the neighborhood association and saying when we're going to have the picnic and et cetera, et cetera.
So in that scenario, I would say I don't see a reason why that risks a potential Open Public Meetings Act violation. And the reason is because they wouldn't be discussing issues that are likely to come before, you know, that person on the body that they serve. So, you know, if four of you happen to be in the same neighborhood association, you can certainly talk about neighborhood association business, but you couldn't talk about planning commission business.
Right. That's what I always thought, and then I heard otherwise, and I thought, since you're here.
Yes, please, glad we can answer.
Can I stand on that? The example that Commissioner Walter gave, what if, for example, let's say we, the Newport Hills community, they have four planning commissioners who live in the Newport Hills community, and at one point we had a zoning change coming to us about a specific site in the community, and the public was very vocal about it, and for a fact we knew that at Neighborhood Association, discussion about that topic came about. And that's also a topic that came to the commission. Should the four planning commissioners at that meeting be participating in that conversation at the Neighborhood Association level, knowing that this is something that would potentially come to the commission?
I do think that presents a different scenario, and I think that that potentially constitutes action in that it's a discussion of an issue. And so in that situation, I would say that it would be wise to not have a discussion about issues that could potentially come before the Planning Commission if there's a quorum present. If there were two commissioners on the Neighborhood Association, then you don't have a quorum, right? And you don't have a meeting. But if there is four of you, then that's a different scenario.
And you can also listen, obviously. So, I mean, if, even if there is a quorum present, if you're not engaging in debate about it, but you want to be there to see what's happening in the community, that's certainly not an issue.
That would fall in that category of passive receipt of information and not having the intent of taking action. But the second that you started engaging in discussions or asking questions, then that would potentially constitute action under the Open Public Meetings Act.
Can I chime in really quick? Because I believe what Commissioner Walter was referring to is perhaps the community council. And there, the city has taken a position that out of an abundance of caution, we do notice, if they, we know that there is going to be a quorum present, we do notice specific meetings as special meetings, just out of an abundance of caution.
Well, and that is another way of dealing with it, by the way, is if, for example, you think that there is going to be a quorum of anybody present at a meeting, like, for example, what you were describing, where they may engage in debate, then you can notice it. It's not that you can't do it.
Right.
It's that you have to go through those procedures. So, and a meeting can be noticed in a different location. And, I mean, there's a number of ways of dealing with that. It's not uncommon for bodies, for example, to take field trips to locations and notice those as special meetings as well, because they want to be able to talk about what's happening wherever they're going.
But then, of course, if you do that, it does truly need to be open to the public.
Right.
So. Okay. Any final questions on the Public Meetings Act? With that, we're on the next slide.
I do have a question.
Sure.
So you said it does truly need to be open to the public. So what constitutes, like, open to the public? Is it that they have awareness of what transpired, or is it that they have the opportunity to provide input? What counts as open?
So, I mean, I think in its most basic form, it means they have to be able to observe what's going on.
And I guess to elaborate slightly on that, you know, we actually changed out some of our graphics this year, and at the beginning of the OPMA section of the slides tonight, we put up the red velvet rope, which was sort of a tribute to the UW Regents. As you may remember, they got into some hot water because they were having these dinners in which they had a quorum present, and they had the dinner was actually roped off to the public, so the public could sort of stand out side and observe, but that was as close as they could get. That was found to be a violation of the law. So, but I think the important thing is, I mean, people have to have the opportunity to participate. They're obviously not required to do that. So if you provide notice and you're in a place that's open to the public, the fact that people may choose not to participate, that's not a legal issue.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, especially as we start moving into this more digital period for the commission, I'm really curious about how this translates, or like how the courts would interpret this when it comes to things like forums. So can we engage in a discussion with the community as long as the community has been notified and everybody has access, let's say, to next door? Like, boundaries like that, I'm really curious about, because I get it in terms of the very arcane physical sense, but I'd like to know more from a digital sense.
Well, I think the courts have been, you know, fairly rigorous in applying the concepts that have existed pre-digital to digital usage. And so, for example, you know, that's how this whole email case came about in 2001. That's how some of the cases I'm about to talk about in the public records section came up with respect to social media and cell phones. So I think you have to assume that the courts are going to probably treat it by applying the existing law as closely as possible to the digital framework. And unfortunately, sometimes that may not be the most pragmatic solution, you know, in terms of how to operate as a local governing body. But that is unfortunately, I think, a lot of what we've seen. And in part of, obviously, the job of the advocates that are presenting those issues to the courts is to make sure the courts understand that. But I think the best course of action, too, is if you are contemplating something like a community meeting, then, you know, check in with staff or with the city attorney's office in advance, because a lot of that can just be addressed in advance and it becomes a non-issue.
Sure. Thanks.
I have a follow-up to his question. So if the social neighborhood networking site Nextdoor, for example, if you want to post a comment, if you precede that comment with the fact that this is your opinion as a resident versus a planning commissioner, does that make a difference?
I mean, if you had a quorum of the rest of your body engaging with you on that issue on social media, I think that you would risk a potential violation of the Open Public Meetings Act. I don't think it matters whether it's in your personal capacity or not. The definition is, you know, action, you know, deliberations, and, you know, with a majority of your body. So
I would say you raise an interesting First Amendment issue, which is similar to something I'm going to talk about in a few moments. I'm not sure it's something we'd want to spend a year or two, you know, trying to figure out the answer to in federal court, but I do think that there are questions at a certain outer limit of when you have a right of personal expression in your individual capacity. You don't completely surrender that by virtue of serving on the board. So, you know, and I think also that if you're commenting in a community forum, probably in that scenario, it seems less likely that you would have multiple commissioners doing the same thing. That's what would cause the issue.
Right.
I mean, if you're in your individual capacity and you're commenting on a community forum, that's not a meeting. Okay. On to the Public Records Act, which is certainly a law that I think just about everybody who is involved in government in a way in the state has at least heard something about. Next slide. The Public Records Act, it arose out of a citizen initiative in the early 1970s, and it has continued to evolve since that time, but the basic framework remains as it was, which is that any public records are subject to disclosure if they're requested by a member of the public, and they are only withheld from disclosure if there is a specific exemption that has been created by the legislature. So courts and local governments don't get to decide what those exemptions should be. Those exemptions have been set out in advance, and they either apply or they don't apply. Sometimes it's a slightly more difficult question to figure that out, but those are the only exemptions that are allowed to disclosure, and there is a very strong presumption that the courts also follow and enforce in favor of disclosure. Just like the Public Records Act, just like the Open Public Meetings Act, the Public Records Act has a mandatory training requirement as well. And also, as a practical matter, training is very important because the Public Records Act touches virtually all aspects of government transactions. And for that matter, in the event that there's ever a challenge or a lawsuit relating to public records, the fact that you've been trained and made good faith efforts to comply with the Act makes a big difference. And so it's always, as a practical matter, a good thing to have a basic understanding of these concepts as well. Next slide. So the scope of the PRA, it's extremely broad. It applies to anything that is a writing, and if the writing pertains to the performance or conduct of any government function, and if it is prepared, owned, used, or retained, those are sort of the four magic words, by the government agency in question. So as you can see, that is an extremely broad set of criteria. For example, it doesn't have to be a record that resides here at the city, if the city used it, nor does it have to be something that the city uses if they own it or prepared it, or it could be something that is created entirely by somebody else if the city chooses to retain it or keep it on premises. So a lot of different ways that you can end up with a public record, the key being, again, if it in any way relates to the conduct of government or the performance of government functions. And the word writing is also extremely broad. It was a lot simpler when this initiative was passed in the 70s, but now it includes not just paper or emails, but virtually any form of electronic record that you can think of is encompassed within the definition. And so that, as you can imagine, has created a lot of additional issues and questions about how do we produce and retain records that have that fall within the Public Records Act when they're now located in so many different places and in so many different forms. Next slide. This is just an example of how broad the Supreme Court has been interpreting the Act. This, for example, is a case from a few years ago in which they said that any compilation of raw data that's kept in a database held by a government agency is a public record, even if you have to essentially print it out or format it in some fashion to deliver it to a requester. It used to be that that was essentially considered the creation of a new record, which you don't have to do in response to a request, but now they have said if you have this information, it's readily available in your system, you need to produce it. Next slide. It's hard to believe that it was only the year 2000 that the courts were really struggling with the question of whether an email was a public record, but that was the first time that they really began looking at that issue, because I think that's the first time, or that's around the time that email use was really taking off in terms of pervasive government forms of communication. And there's been sort of a dichotomy that's been developed over the years about emails and whether or not they are public records. And it's generally that if the email has anything to do with the government or your duties as a planning commissioner, it's going to be considered a public record. And that's going to be true whether it is an email that's on your, for example, newly issued official planning commission email, or whether it's an email that is on your personal account if it has to do with the conduct of government. On the other hand, if you have purely personal emails, that is, emails that have no relation to government function, then those should not be considered public records. So, for example, if you are responding about a grocery list or something like that, even if it was on your Planning Commission email, that might arguably be excluded from the Public Records Act. But as a general matter, it's certainly a good idea to avoid using your official email addresses for anything that you don't want to be potentially subject to a Public Records Act request. Next slide. This is a case that was just decided by the Washington Court of Appeals. Review was denied by the Washington Supreme Court, and there is now a petition pending with the United States Supreme Court. The case is called West versus Vermillion, and I call this to your attention because it's of particular significance to you as members of a commission for the city. It related to the question of whether or not court could require a search of emails on a personal email account of a city council member, and that was Mr. Vermillion. And despite some pretty strong constitutional arguments to the contrary, the Court of Appeals said, yes, you can. And so what does that mean as a practical matter? It means that that's a possibility. If you're transacting a lot of Planning Commission business on a personal email account, there is a possibility that that account could be subject to review if there's a public records request that encompasses materials that are on there. Now, however, it should never come to that, because there's another case, next slide, called Nissen versus Pierce County, which got a lot of publicity a couple of years ago. The Nissen case related to the Pierce County prosecutor, and the Pierce County prosecutor, there were two issues in this case. One is that the prosecutor, despite having two cell phones, one an official county cell phone and one a personal cell phone, decided to transact a lot of business on his personal cell phone. That included texting, and it also included calling. And so there was a public records request made to Pierce County, and the request was, give me all the text messages that relate to this particular subject, even if they're on your personal phone, and give me all of your call logs that reflect the telephone calls that you've made over a particular period of time relating to a particular subject matter. So the trial court in Pierce County made this statement, which, if you read it, sounds reasonable, which says, just because you're serving as an elected official in this case doesn't mean you've given up your constitutional rights. But the Supreme Court had a slightly different view and ultimately overruled this position. But what they did say, and this is the critical part, I think, for all of you, is that if you get a request, and the request potentially encompasses information that is contained on, say, a personal device, going to the next slide here, such as text messages, such as call logs, and this could apply to a personal computer as well, you can provide a good faith affidavit, which is a short sworn statement that the city can help you prepare, indicating that either there are no such records located on those devices, if that's accurate, or that you yourself have gone and searched to determine whether there would be anything responsive that is in fact a public record. So if you had three text messages that related to a comp plan amendment that you had sent on your personal cell phone, those might be responsive and you might have to provide those to the city. But by doing the affidavit in the manner that I described and approved by the Supreme Court, nobody would be looking around in your phone, and you would be able to essentially perform a self-selection process. This is also a really good reason why we segregate information, and I'll talk about this in a bit more detail in a moment, but these types of scenarios are a lot easier to deal with if you have clear dividing lines, as much as that's possible, between any records, communications, or electronic data that you create that relates to your service on the commission versus what you do in your personal life. And again, that's easier said than done, and I certainly recognize that, but if you've got different folders on your computer, if you end up using different phones, if you store things in different places and you're careful to keep them apart, it'll actually make this process a lot easier. I also think that this is one of the reasons why I am really pleased about the rollout with devices and official emails, because I thought it was a very difficult thing when you're a commissioner and you don't have, for example, an official email to perform that segregation. It makes it a lot more complicated. Here, going forward, you're going to have this opportunity for a lot of that segregation to be done for you in advance. And that certainly suggests why it's a good reason to, for example, use those official emails and devices for the official business and use your other personal devices or computers for personal business. Next slide. Thank you. Home computers, I just talked about this, but there were a number of attempts made over the past few years to obtain searches of home computers, generally of council members, but in the Hangartner versus City of Seattle case, there was an all-volunteer board of the Seattle Monorail Project. The King County Superior Court ordered that all of their personal hard drives be searched. Again, I don't think this issue would come to light now because you could use the affidavit procedure I described from Nissen, but it's a reminder that if you are storing records on your home computer that relate to the commission, then they may be fair game. Metadata, next slide. And next slide again, metadata. Colloquially, it's data about data. It's information that is embedded in electronic documents. You generally can't see it. But what it often can tell you is information such as when a document was created, perhaps who has edited the document. I will say that there's a lot of metadata that has no substantive value whatsoever. It tells you things like, you know, what internet node the document came through when it was transmitted to you. But there is some information of importance that can be located in there. And next slide. The Supreme Court in the O'Neill versus Shoreline case indicated that metadata is a public record. They indicated that, for example, if somebody makes a public records request for an email, they're entitled not just to, for example, a printed copy of that email or a PDF of that email. They're entitled to get what we would say is native format, something as it would appear in your Outlook file, for example, or on your phone, because that is the email that would have the information, the metadata in it, that might tell you details about when it was created, who edited it, etc. And so that is also a reason why if a record has a retention value, if it has to be kept for a certain period of time, that means that you're keeping it in a format that protects the metadata. Now, I will say that although this case got a lot of publicity and some people do ask for metadata, you do have to specifically ask for it to get it in a records request. And I would say that more than 9 times out of 10, it's not an issue, just something to be aware of because, for example, again, if you're, for example, storing emails on a personal computer, you know, you need to make sure that you're keeping those in their original format for whatever the retention period might be. Next slide. I talked about segregation. I'm not going to go through all these points because I know we're getting a little long on time, but you've got all this in your materials. These are just a few bullets that talk about how and why you want to make sure you segregate documents as much as possible on devices and personal computers. Next slide. I will mention social media in particular because that's an area where segregation and retention is a little bit blurrier. You know, a lot of attention being paid these days to whether or not you have to retain social media posts. So, for example, if you were a member of the executive branch and you got on Twitter every morning and shared your thoughts about what was going on in the country, would you be creating public records? Well, the White House Counsel's Office says you are. They say, for example, that some of those statements are official policy. There's a lawsuit going on right now in federal court relating to that issue. It's a different standard. It's under the Presidential Records Act, in case you didn't guess what I was talking about. But I think that the point of that, though, is there is a very intense focus these days on social media usage by all public actors. And it's something you need to be aware of if you are on social media. And certainly, to the extent that you are engaging in any community communications, for example, in your capacity as a commissioner, you may be creating social media posts that have a retention value and have to be kept for some period of time. So something to be aware of. You know, and I should also emphasize, it certainly does not preclude you from social media use in your personal capacity. And obviously, people use all these functions in their personal capacity. People often have multiple accounts just for that reason. Next slide. And there is a policy on social media. I know it's a constantly evolving policy. I won't get into the details of it, but certainly something you want to be aware of. Being in compliance with the policy is always going to be a good thing for you and for the city. Again, in terms of there's ever any inquiry or challenge to a public records request. Next slide. Retention, this is a complicated process. It's not something that you need to have memorized. It's subject to a very detailed schedule that's created by the Secretary of State and the archives. However, staff should have retention information. They should be working with you to store and keep information. This is another aspect of the new rollout that I think is going to be great because it will allow retention to be done on a much easier basis. If your emails are or, for example, on an official planning commission email that's on the city server, then it's not something you have to be worrying about in terms of retention, and that's the same with your devices. If your devices are city devices, you don't have to worry about what happens if there's a personal device, you change carriers, you know, information accidentally gets deleted, etc. But this is more, yes.
So as you know, we don't have personal email address yet. So far we've been communicating with staff with our, wait, let me rephrase that. We don't have a public email address yet. So we've been communicating with staff with our personal email address. So are we obligated to keep those for 6 years?
No. So that's a very good question. And the six-year requirement is only for a narrow category of what's considered official public records. And those are usually documents such as the agenda, the minutes, and any recommendations or resolutions that the commission passes. Office files and memoranda are subject to a more limited retention period, and a lot of communications have no retention value. They can be deleted basically immediately. The only exception to that is if there is a records request for something, even if it was no longer required to be retained, once the request has come in, you can't get rid of it until the request has been resolved. So that is a good reason to not only be aware of things such as documents that don't have retention value, but to not hang on to those unduly for an extended period of time. Because if you do, and somebody asks for them, then you got to go through, you have to look through them all, and you may have to hand them over. Yes, I understand that to date the practice has been that that staff have worked with you to preserve those communications and emails. And what I'm saying is this is a process that I think is going to get a lot easier and be a lot more streamlined once your emails are already on the system and we're essentially cutting out that middle step. Similarly, like with the open meetings issues, if you have questions about retention, how long do I need to be keeping something, what about this particular device, ask. There's never any harm in asking, and a lot of time the answers are really simple, and it'll give you peace of mind. Next slide, retention of emails. I won't go through these bullets, but again, this gives you a little bit more detail about types of emails that may have retention value versus those that may not. Next slide. And further information about this, there's an agreement also with the State Archives in place about this, and staff, I think, has more details about that. Next slide. How requests are handled. This is an important issue, and fortunately for everybody here on the commission, the city has a robust infrastructure in place to address and respond to requests, something that Jessica and I are both very familiar with and have worked with the city on a number of fronts. The bottom line is that virtually all requests should be coming in independent of you, and so you'll probably be hearing about these requests from somebody, for example, in the clerk's office coming to you and saying, hey, we have a request we received, we would like to get any emails that the commission has with respect to this particular resolution or this particular zoning proposal. And then you'll simply be in a position of helping them search for and obtain those records. If by some chance any of you do receive a records request on your own, for example, somebody emails you, and this does happen, and says, I'd like copies of X, Y, or Z, forward that on to staff right away. The reason is that an initial response is due within 5 business days. The initial response is usually just, okay, we're looking into it. We expect we can either give it to you right now because we know that it's on our website or it's readily available, or it's going to take a week for us to look through these emails and compile them. But you have to get that initial response out right away. There may be other nuances with the request that aren't immediately apparent. And so that's why, because there are so many people here who are expertly trained in this process, to just forward that along. And if you're not sure whether it's a request, same thing. there's no magic words that have to be used. Sometimes people will ask for something, and they'll do it either in a cagey way deliberately, or they'll do it in a way that they don't know. And nevertheless, that could still be considered a request. So if someone is asking you for documents or records in some way, forward that on. Next slide. And this is just a case where there was some discussion about the fact that even though the city of Seattle had responded to a request in a timely manner, ultimately they did not send the five-day letter that I mentioned, and that was considered a violation of the act, even though the records themselves got there within a reasonable time, which is what the requirement was. Next slide. The other thing I would mention from that same case, which is very important, is there's a search obligation associated with the act. So, for example, if you do get a call from the clerk's office and they say, you know, I need you to please check and see if you have any emails relating to this particular comp plan amendment, your obligation is to do a reasonable search. And that is, you're supposed to look in all the places that would, you know, fairly be considered to locate those documents. So the fewer places, first of all, where the documents are, the easier that's going to be. If there's six different devices they might be on, that makes it a little bit harder. But the most important thing is that your obligation is not to find every single bit of data, every single email or every single piece of paper. You're supposed to try, but it's a good faith effort, and the search has to be reasonably calculated, as the cases say, to locate the emails. So remember that that's what you'll be judged by, and if you're asked to look for records and you have a question about, you know, whether you're looking in the right place, whether you're doing too much, too little, ask, because that's something that the clerk's office in particular is very familiar with as what constitutes a reasonable search. Next slide. One of the reasons why I mentioned at the beginning that people are so familiar with this law, the Public Records Act, is that it has some hefty monetary provisions in it. And one of the things is that if anybody sues under the Public Records Act and they win, establishing that they should have gotten records that they didn't get, they are entitled to two things. One is attorney's fees, and believe me, that can add up fast. And another is penalties up to $100 per day. And $100 per day, on the one hand, that sounds, oh, maybe that's not that much, but on the other hand, next slide, if you look at this case at the top, this is the case that every public records requester will cite to you whenever they're talking to you about why they need to get more information and what's going to happen if you don't comply. It's more than $500,000 penalty. And the reason why is because it was imposed on essentially a per-page basis. And the Supreme Court said, yep, you have the discretion as a trial court judge to do that. I'm not suggesting that every public records violation remotely results in that type of exposure, but there have been multiple cases over the last few years that have been in that range. Those are usually very, very egregious violations. It's another example, though, of just by being here and listening to this and understanding the basic concepts, we will not have those types of things happening with the city. And it's also a good reason why, again, if you ask in advance, you won't find yourself, the city won't find itself in that situation. Next slide. I'm not going to go through these in detail because I think they're more applicable to the staff level, but basically there's been a series of amendments in 2017 to this law. A number of them relate to response times and scope of requests, which is something that the clerk's office primarily will handle. One other thing I'll mention, next slide. There is now a much broader cost-shifting provision in the statute, and this is designed to address large electronic requests, which we're getting, I think, the legislature correctly considered out of hand. And now there's an opportunity for the city to recoup costs associated with large data retrieval requests. Probably not something you're going to be faced with, but something to keep in mind. And if cost is going to be an issue, recovering or searching for records, there may be ways to pass some of that on, or at least have a negotiation or discussion with the requester about that. Next slide. I'm going to very briefly reiterate this. It's a different section of the Public Disclosure Act, but it's always worth mentioning, especially as we head into the fall, which is that you can't use city facilities and city resources to support a candidate or to support a ballot proposition. That's the two forms of electoral politics that this prohibition applies to. There are exceptions. Next slide. Primarily that you can develop an objective and fair presentation of the facts, post that information on the website. You can also debate these types of things in an open meeting if you want to do that. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions if there are any further questions on the Public Records Act. And if not, thank you very much.
Did we get a copy of this handout?
I got the PowerPoint presentation late this afternoon, and I just made a note that I'll send it all out to you tomorrow morning.
Okay, that would be great.
And similarly, if you have questions that occur to you after the meeting and you want to email those along or anything like that, we're happy to follow up.
Yeah, this just seriously heightened my paranoia.
All right, glad to hear we did our job. So,
thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And you're good for 4 years.
Yeah,
that's right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you to Matt and Jessica for that. I have just passed out a quick fact sheet for you with regard to RCW 4014. So kind of further defining the public constitutes a public record, and then giving you some tips and guidelines on how to manage your commission-related email, since we are actually rolling out individual email addresses to you as part of this digital transition. And then I'll take the opportunity to introduce Kathy Ebner. She's our public records officer, so Matt, in his portion of the presentation, talked about public records requests. Kathy is our public records officer, so she is the one who takes in all public records requests for the city. Again, if you do, just very important, if you do receive requests for information for them to Terry, Terry will get them to Kathy, or you can send them to Kathy directly.
Charmaine, can I get a copy of that for the record?
Yes. All right. So, what I would like to do next is connect to one of the iPads and kind of give you a live demo of what you're going to be seeing when we give you your iPads. So, kind of walk you through a little bit of the functionality of what we're going to deliver to you shortly. Come on. There it is. Okay. So after I do this little live demo, you will get your iPads, and Chris from IT will come up and talk to you a little bit of logging on initially. But once you actually log on to your individual devices, we've loaded everything on the homepage that you're going to need to get to immediately. So you'll see this. There it is. This iLegislate app is how you're going to access your commission packets from now on. So if you click on that, it will automatically, I have logged you all in on your devices. You're set up with your email address and passwords. I've logged you into the iLegislate app, and it will not ask you to log in again. It will automatically bring you to this agendas tab. So as soon as you click on the app, this is what will show every time you open the app. Currently, all that's listed in here is your commission packet for this evening's meeting, because this is the first packet that we've put into the system. Eventually, as more packets and each week or each meeting is loaded, you will see they will scroll. So you can actually continue to scroll for many, many lines. You can keep multiple meetings in here so you can go back and refer to them. You do have the option of deleting meetings. If you don't want to see a list of, 50 meetings after a period of time, you can go in and individually delete them. It doesn't delete them in the system. It just deletes them off of your device. device, so you don't need to see them or scroll through them any longer. Just kind of showing you a little bit on the homepage. This is your refresh button. If things aren't functioning, that's what we say, always click on refresh and see if it will reload itself. This, of course, is the agendas tab that we're on right now. If you click on the bookmarks tab, I'll show you how to bookmark items here shortly, but if you want to view everything that you've bookmarked, you would click on this tab. Same thing with the notes tab. Once you click on this, this will show a scrolling list of anything that you've noted. The videos tab is actually, of course, we don't video record the Planning Commission meetings, so there are no Planning Commission videos here, but kind of as an extra bonus, you will get to see council meeting videos on your individual device as opposed to going to the website. The other two tabs on the homepage, it's very hard to see, I apologize, but this says ideas, and this is accounts. The ideas is a module of Granicus and of Legistar that the city does not currently utilize, so that tab does not function. The accounts is just your personal account. I happen to be using Commissioner Barksdale's iPad for this demonstration, since he is not here tonight. If you did participate with another agency that also used Granicus, you could add additional accounts in here. That isn't the case for any of you currently. So going back to the agendas tab, when you click on your agenda, it will bring up all of the items that are listed on that evening's agenda. So you'll hear a little bit more when we roll out the bylaws here shortly, but the commission's agendas will contain 13 items on each agenda, starting with roll call and going all the way to adjournment. So this is kind of following the city council order of business. There is some flexibility here, but this is the order that we have put into Legistar. We have worked with Mr. Cullen. We have put all potential items for commission business in this list. If you're familiar with looking at council agendas, I'll just say that each particular item or each agenda item, if there is something underneath that item for action or for discussion, you will see it show up. If obviously there's nothing under call to order and there's nothing under roll call, so if you follow that format, you'll be able to tell which items actually have items of business. So I will pop into the first item of actual business where you'll see the paperclip. This will bring you to your main screen for that item. Off to the right-hand side are all of your attachments. This particular item is Mr. Cullen's forward-looking calendar for the commission meeting schedule. So there is no agenda memo. It is just the meeting schedule. So if you click on the schedule or on the PDF, it will bring you into the item. This one is only one page, so that's all you're seeing. Clicking back, always, in the upper left, will take you back to the page that you were just on. If this is something that you wanted to take notes about, you could use this notes section down below. You can type in your notes, save your note, go back to the agenda, and then your note will appear. If there's something, if Mr. Cullen is absent from a meeting and you do a roll call and he normally calls roll, you can make a note to yourself that whoever is replacing Mr. Cullen for the evening is taking roll. If you want to go in and delete that note, simply come back in, delete your note, and save and come back.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
I'm not seeing how you got the note on the item that you wanted. So can you just
So you come back into the item. And then you click with it. It's very hard to see. This is actually a dark yellow or kind of a bright yellow box. The lighting in here is not so great. On your iPad, you can see that it's actually yellow. So you just touch the screen, and it pops into this note field.
So you're not going down to the thing at the bottom where it says notes. That's independent. That's something separate.
No, right here. This,
right
where it says my notes, when you touch within that box, it pops you into this separate box.
That makes total sense.
Yep.
Now I get it.
Get it.
You got two places that notes go, and that's just...
So that's a note for this particular item. I'll show you. I'll go to a longer... your Planning Commission bylaws is actually a lengthy document, so I will show you that. So you'll see up on the right-hand side, you'll see the agenda memo, which typically would be your first item, and then any attachments would follow under this list. So the agenda memo itself is only one page, I know, but the draft bylaws are 10 pages long. So you'll see here that it's 10 pages. A lot of the annotating that you can do, it's great. Consider this much like paper. So if you want to highlight, you come down here, click on highlight. It will bring up this box. You touch the screen with whatever you want to highlight. It highlights. You click done. And you have now highlighted this section. The same is true for underline. You can choose color. You can underline an item. Same thing with draw. This actually works great if you decide, you know what, I really don't like that section. Take that out. Like done. These are just your notes. These are the same. Consider this the same as writing on your paper agenda. When you go through your packet and you're making notes to yourself, this is the same thing.
Okay, so maybe you can get there. But if I I write on my packets and I write. Obviously, I can't use handwriting, but is there a place to like stick a text box right next to something so that I can?
Yep.
You were going to
yep.
get there.
Nope, you're good. You're fine. So you can actually use that draw and use your finger to, obviously, that might not come out the best, but this note section, you can click on an area that you want to notate. So if I just touched, obviously you can't see my finger, but I just touched next to the word functions and it brings up this text box. So then you can use your keyboard and type whatever note it is that you want. Then you touch outside of that box anywhere.
All right,
and then
just
your note
won me
saved.
Over.
Okay, yay. Mission accomplished.
Okay. All I wanted to be able to do.
So then moving on, the bookmark works really similarly to the note. I'm going to scroll. Come here. I'm sorry, I'm doing this left and right hand and not working so well. So say I want to bookmark the second page. So I'll go to the second page, click bookmark. I clicked on this word, vice chair. It comes in and it will name it automatically bookmark 1, bookmark 2, bookmark 3, sequentially. If I decide I want to name this something else, I type what I want it to be, click outside of the box. And then if I go up here, you'll see up here chapters, bookmarks, and pages. If I click on bookmarks, it will automatically take me to the page that contains that bookmark when I click on it. So you can, this is a 10-page document, you can add as many bookmarks as you want, and it will take you automatically to that section of that particular item. This left or this black box on the right nav, if you click on that, if it's a multiple page document, that will bring up a list of the pages. You can scroll through those, click directly on the page that you want to go to, and then it takes you there. Obviously, refresh is self-explanatory. Email. Now that you do have city-owned devices and city-issued emails, if you click on email, that will automatically attach this document into an email, which then you just address, and it automatically populates with this, please review this attachment. Obviously, you can change that to whatever language you want, and then send that item. I'm going to cancel out of that. Going back to item details, you will see you can add bookmarks for this particular item as opposed to adding bookmarks within the attachments themselves. These arrows on the bottom will automatically take you forward or backwards on the agenda to either the next item or the previous item. So if I click on, I clicked on this, so it took me to the next item on the agenda, which is election of officers. that has one attachment, and it's an agenda memo. And it's loaded. So, that in a nutshell is a high level what is available to you. This particular email will email the agenda, high level details of the agenda. This download box, actually, if you are planning a trip, say, away for the weekend, you know that you're not going to have Wi-Fi, but you need to review your Planning Commission packet, download this, and it downloads to your actual device, so you don't need to have Wi-Fi, so then you can actually read those items without being connected to Wi-Fi. If you don't have to do it, I wouldn't suggest doing this, because that then, once it's downloaded to the actual device, does start taking up space. So just keep that in mind, that that's something that you can utilize if you are going to be away from Wi-Fi and need to review packet materials. This change view up at the top, you can actually change, once you start getting lots of agendas on here, or you're making lots of notes or bookmarks, you can change your view. It automatically defaults to this agenda view, but you can change it to notes and or bookmarks. Obviously, you don't have any in here yet. The one last thing. No. Does anybody have any questions about any of the functionality? I will email out a high-level overview of what we just talked about. It's just, I would just suggest getting in here and playing around with this particular packet. This packet was still published on our website in the old format, so this is something that you can play around with as soon as we give you your devices and start to get more comfortable with it.
And we will be producing the packet in paper form, too, for the next few months, and it will be based on what you see up there. So it'll have a slightly different look than what you've been currently experiencing. It'll match more what is on the iLegislator or iLegislate.
Okay.
And when you're, and it'll be similar. You'll get an email about a week prior, and it'll say that your packet's ready and it's been uploaded, and you'll be able to go directly to pick up your tablet and be able to access it immediately.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do we bring the iPad back to staff if we need an app added? For example, if I'm out of town and I need to use Skype to dial in and I only want to use one device?
Absolutely. We did not add any additional apps to the iPads at this point, and we've locked down the functionality, like no texting, no taking pictures with the camera. Those devices have been locked down, but certainly Skype is something that the commission, if you adopt your new bylaws, at some point does allow for that sort of participation, and that is something that we could review and put onto the iPad for you. So if there aren't any other questions, I would like Chris Jaloki to come up and talk to you a little bit about our technology resource usage policy, because we are issuing you city-owned devices and city emails. So he can talk a little bit about that, and he will also walk you through getting onto your iPads, which I will hand out to you now.
Yeah, drum roll as you're handing.
Everybody, I'm gonna hand you just one for the record.
Okay. Thank you very much.
What if they're lost or stolen?
Thank you.
That's a good question, actually. So these are sit down, but not. These are actually on our mobile device management application,
yeah.
Called Cisco Meraki, and within depending on if it's on and connected to cell networks, we could track it down considerably through that. So if it is lost or stolen, if you let us know, we might be able to get it back within a reasonable period of time. So it's a... Okay. Awesome. All right. Well,
Good evening, everyone. As if you haven't heard enough legalese today, we're going to walk through the trap a little bit.
Just introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. My name is Chris Jaloki. I'm with the IT department here at the City of Bellevue. Basically, we're going to walk through a high-level overview of the Technology Resource Usage Policy, otherwise known as the TRUP. We're going to cover the high-level stuff that pertains to employees as well as other users of city-owned equipment. And so, basically, the TRUP starts out by talking about that these are city-owned devices. They're not really meant for exclusively for personal use, although that incidentally can happen. So beware that whenever you're on this iPad or whatnot, you are is open for public records. I mean, this is what we talked about earlier today. There's no right to privacy on these devices. Exercise good judgment on it while using the device. And just be aware that these are being maintained via some city equipment that we use to push out updates and push out applications if needed to use. So let me pull up notes here, make sure I'm covering everything I need to. All right. And as it was alluded to earlier, we do have these fairly restricted to avoid any potential conflicts with public records. Primarily, the only way that's going to be we'll have records on it, will be through email. And one of the great things I wanted to show you on here is through the mail app here, down below. This should come preloaded, I believe, with... Oh, that's right, because there's nothing in here. So this is your mail app, and this is a pretty uniform look and feel throughout everyone's iPads unless you change them around. The bottom is the icon here with the mail icon will take you to here. And this is where you'll see this, obviously, because these are brand new accounts, don't have any pre-existing emails in there. You can actually click on or tap on the inbox to go into the inbox and see any messages in there. And I believe we're using records retention on these, so you should be able to move email messages to appropriate records retention inboxes.
Is passcode and password the same thing?
No, we're going to get into that just in a little bit. They're two separate things, and we'll walk through that in just a moment here. this is the mail app, and as was talked about earlier on in the meeting, if you have any questions regarding these or any issues that you want to have resolved, you can reach out to Terry, and then he will in turn reach out to us, and we're more than happy to help. We're here to help, and this is something we do on a daily, if not hourly, basis.
Should these icons be on our screensaver right now?
It depends on what screen you're on.
I'm on this screen.
Okay.
Cool. So,
where's home?
So, if you fix out of that, then it will ask you for your 4-digit.
All right. Chris, why don't you continue on? You need to get through the technology and resource use policy.
Yes, absolutely.
First.
Absolutely. Okay.
Focus on the actual iPads.
All right. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, like I said before, the ownership of the data will be through the city. Devices will be monitored through our Cisco Meraki mobile device management application. It manages the high-level functions of the device. It'll manage the data, manage the apps that are on there, and we can pull up records of locations of data usage by month or what have you. So they will be monitored on a regular basis, not actively, but more passively. If we're alerted to something, we'll keep it under observation there. As was alluded to earlier, these are open for public records disclosure requests. So keep in mind, anything on here will be subject to that. You can use these for incidental personal use. It's not necessarily something we restrict on there. If you needed to look up something in Safari or something like that, you have that capability. But keep in mind, it needs to adhere with everything that's listed in the TRUP. And while I'm on that, while we're not covering everything in the TRUP, I highly would encourage you to read through this when you have some time. There's nothing to sign per se, but it gives you a good idea of what policies and procedures we have in place.
So let's say I was writing a freelance article for, you know, the Seattle Times, and I was writing it on this. Is that now a public document that someone could, you know, file a public records request to look at my draft of an article? Okay. So basically everything that we do on this, internet searches, you know, email, everything is subject to public records inspection. Okay.
Right, and as the attorneys from Pacifica Law Group pointed out, what's nice about it is now you're able to segregate all your Planning Commission business to one device. So you don't have a fear or a concern that, per se, they're going to come after you with your personal computer on things that happen from here on out. Maybe for past records, but for what you do from here on out, if you do it with this device, then you'll be in a better comfort zone.
So every note or edit I make on our agenda, which is now private,
it's suddenly not private now. You're supposed to be keeping copies. That's your notes and everything you do on your paper copies are public record.
I'm not sure we ever knew that before. I'm certainly not aware of that.
Okay.
That question actually came up at a different time when we were getting iPads. And I actually asked the question, the distinction between what I write in my handwritten packet versus what will be on the screen. And there was, in that meeting, I was given the answer that what's in my paper copy is mine, and then this would be public. So that's a different answer than I'd stuck in my brain.
That's not my...
Your notes on... They may be transitory in nature. It depends on what your notes are. If you're just taking simple notes on your agendas, if you do not need them for your purposes, then you don't need them.
Then I don't need to keep them.
Right.
Good thing.
Okay, so continuing on with the messaging topic here, pretty much this is limited at this moment to just email and possibly Skype, but down the line it could extend out to messaging. Just make sure that the email content must be consistent with the same standards expected through other forms of communication, and also make sure that the content of those messages are adhering to the City of Bellevue's standards as far as not being obscene or harassing or threatening or have any having no legitimate or lawful purpose. So just making sure that the content being translated there is above the board. And then also, if there are any personal uses of messaging system that differ from those of the city policy, they must contain the following disclaimer that's listed below. So just a heads up there. And then also, so this kind of gets to John's question earlier about PIN codes versus passwords. There's two different types of authentication for the device. The PIN code, which actually gets you into the device, which is shown here. If you tap on the home screen, which I'll get into the fundamentals of the device here shortly. This is where you would enter your PIN code, which you'll see it now, so we'll have to change it on this one. But... this will let you into the device. The password is something that should be on the document that was handed to you earlier with the iPad. It has your unique PIN code and password on there. If for some reason you do need to change that password, there are steps on that document that walk you through that process. But if you work with Terry, we'll work with him to get the passwords changed if need be. So just to let you know that those passwords are there, but if we need to change them for some reason, they can be done. And it walks you through the process there, too. Moving along, obviously don't share the passwords or PIN codes with anybody. It's something that should remain, for privacy's sake, for just you. Along with that, that's actually all I had to cover on the TRUP. And if there are no questions, we'll move along to the device real quick and walk through the basics of the device.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Have you disabled any of the Outlook tools? In other words, am I able to create subfolders? Am I able to archive emails if I choose to do so?
Yes, absolutely. You should have that functionality to archive emails and to move them to specific folders for sure.
Okay.
And I will say, too, that the Planning Commission emails will have permanent retention on them, so they will not be deleted in the system.
Okay. So looking at the device itself, you can kind of see it in two different sections. There's the keyboard, and then there's the iPad itself. The iPad, for those of you who aren't familiar, there's a couple buttons to be wary of here. Looking at the device with the silver circle towards the bottom, the top right corner will have the power button, which will turn it on and off. And then right next to that, 90 degrees to it, would be the volume up or volume down buttons. And the other button of importance would be this home button, which is the silver outline button on the front of the device, on the face of the device. That will actually also turn on the screen as well. You can configure these to use your thumbprint or your fingerprint to authenticate to the device, which in lieu of a passcode, since this isn't my device, it's not going to do that. So by doing that, since I don't have a thumbprint on here, I have to use a PIN code, which is easy enough done. And then once you're on the screen, this is called a home screen. You'll see you can swipe through other different applications that are on here. Obviously, you see the iLegislate here, and then right next to it, you see the Flipping Book reader app, which I think some...
The comp plan is loaded in the Flipping Book. So if you need to refer to the comp plan during your meetings, the Flipping Book app right next to iLegislate will get you to.
Where's the on and off button?
This.
If you look at top left corner on the side, along the side, right there.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
I can do the thumbprint the same as the iPhone.
How many other buttons are on this besides that?
It's this one.
Is that the only button on this?
So, if I put my thumbprint on here, there's something that's going to happen remotely anytime I'm within Wi-Fi range in terms of updates to this.
No. The thumbprint basically will be... You can use it for authentication as far as if you...
instead of putting in my passcode?
Yes. Yeah. It's the PIN code. The PIN code.
Okay.
Yeah.
Passcode and PIN aren't the same?
Yeah, there's a password and a PIN. Passcode they might have used in it. I didn't write the documentation.
Yeah, it's saying passcode, and it's referring to the PIN.
There is passcode probably is they're using it synonymously. Passcode, I think of it like a PIN code, and then just a password. So I kind of tend to segregate the two just for clarity. But yeah, you're absolutely right that you could do that. Since these are locked down, you wouldn't use the thumbprint or fingerprint authentication, but you could use it for installing apps and that sort of thing. So that's
is
the other
Safari
reason.
Safari the only internet browser?
That's correct. Yes, it is. Yeah.
So if I listen to some songs on YouTube, that's city business now.
You may not even have the YouTube app.
Yeah, it's there. I'm looking at it.
Does anyone have any questions about turning it
on? What's your home phone number?
I'm excited about the Flipping Book app because that is a new app that we got about a... application about a year or two ago, and we've loaded up volume one of the comprehensive plan on it, and you can search through that comprehensive plan your heart's content, and I'm going to start encouraging we use it more in our deliberations because you guys are the foremost policy gatekeepers and policy interpreters of the plan.
You know what would be really helpful to have on here? Google Maps.
Did Google Maps get up? It is on there. It should be on there.
It
should be
on there. Second, if you are on your home.
Got it.
Yeah,
I got it.
Yep.
So you've won me over twice. Quite excited.
Did we get Google Earth on there too for them?
Currently, it's just Google Maps.
Yeah. Google Maps. Okay.
We can push that out though.
When you say push it out, what it's going to just magically show up one day?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
More or less, it will prompt you saying Meraki MDM wants to install the application, and we have a mechanism where we can push it out silently, and you basically will just see it show up. makes it a little easier.
So is our agenda today somewhere on this?
It's in your iLegislate app, so that's where you'll always go for your agendas.
So just
there's the bookmarks, the notes, the videos, the highlights.
It's, you go to your iLegislate app, and you all might want to just try it real quick so you can see what it looks like.
You have to go into the agenda you want, the item you want to highlight.
Okay. So the way I'm approaching it, this is we're going to grow into this. So we'll have a transition period of a couple of months and get everyone comfortable with its functionality, and we'll learn from the experience. All right?
Thank you. And there's just one other
Greg
thing. I'm sorry. There's just one other thing I wanted to highlight, too. So there's the iPad part, but there's also the keyboard part. And what I love about these keyboards is they're already paired to your devices, and they will turn on whenever you connect them to your device. And what I mean by that is, so you can have it just normally like this, and it's off, and you put this thing on and magnetically attaches, you'll notice the green light in the corner, and that just means it's connected. So you will need to charge these at certain points, and you should be given a little micro USB dongle to plug it into a wall like you would charge a phone or any other device that uses that. That would basically be...
Question. Do we have the
do that charge with them?
Yeah, they're in the box over here, and I'll give them to you before you leave. Okay. Both a charger for the iPad and then a charger for the keyboard.
So we have a nice 18-month break-in period before, and then make the full transition.
Sounds like a plan, John.
Emphasis on transition period. Chair Davidos, I believe Vice Chair Walter, you had a question?
Where's the undo button?
Are you in iLegislate?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Don't pay
it. It's my favorite button on any computer.
Are you trying to back out of the program, or are you trying to undo and edit?
Trying to undo and edit.
Okay.
Undo is my best friend.
Sure. They're going to walk you through on the screen.
So I'll come into the bylaws, because it's a lengthy document. So if, say, I went and I made those bookmarks and that highlight and that draw, if you click on the highlight, it brings up in the upper right-hand corner, you see the trash can where you can delete. You can resize that highlight. You can change the color. You can make a note on top of that highlight, whatever it happens to be. So you click on delete, confirm your deletion, and then that goes away.
One more time. How did you get there?
So I'll do this one on the highlight. So if I click on the highlight itself, I touched my finger onto the highlight. It starts flashing. And then in the upper right-hand corner, you see the trash can. You can change colors.
So I underlined something.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to touch it.
Okay, so it's just... Yeah. And then it goes away.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Any other questions about the app itself?
So, Jeremy, are you jealous that we have these right in our hot little hands and you do not?
I was just thinking, you know, I mean, could I get a Surface?
Hey, Jeremy, we've got your iPad here. We've created several public records on your behalf.
I'm reading them all as we speak.
All right. I'd like to thank Chris and Charmaine, and Kristen has been quietly in the back there. Kristen has been doing a lot of the background work to get the iLegislate packets together. She's going to be our key person in the
upper left.
Upcoming times in the packet production. She's the person you don't see, but she's the brains behind the operation, so to speak, production. So I want to thank you, Chris and Charmaine, for staying as long as you have tonight and walking us through this.
Back to page one.
Are there any last minute questions before we call?
How do you turn pages?
I'm sorry?
How do you turn pages?
What app are you in? The iLegislate?
I'm looking at the, yes, meeting schedule under iLegislate.
There is only one page to that particular document. So
how do I go back to the original?
Yep.
And okay.
Go back again. And then if you open the bylaws, mm-hmm. that's a multiple page document, so then you can scroll through pages. The bylaws.
Got it. Okay. Yes, 18 months and we'll be there.
Well, and I will say we are absolutely here anytime. Our office, obviously, we work with the council members. We will work with all of the commission members. As Terry alluded to, there are other commissions who are really interested in this, and it certainly is a huge cost savings to the city. So hopefully you all find this useful and pleasant transition.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right on schedule, I think.
Does this come off of here? Can
Sorry?
You just
right on schedule.
Yeah.
You can pop it right out.
That's okay.
Yeah. Oh, you just popped it out.
You had to say the magic word.
Yep.
Do we get to buy these when our terms are over?
You like it?
Pretty much. Pretty nice.
Okay. I'm going to wait for the chair.
Can you turn it off just by closing it?
Mm-hmm. Just flatten it.
All right, Chair Davidus, are you ready for the next item?
Yeah.
I don't
very much on your right as well.
Do you want to take a 5 minute?
Okay,
would you call a biological break?
Yes.
All right. Sam, so taking a 5 minute bio
or
break.
Or a dessert.
Can I have the name of your nail polish? Ha ha! Like,
it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
do it.
And I told her, you know, when that issue came up.
You get to be free on Amazon Prime and get a new TV tonight for
me.
And then when you're downstairs.
Yeah, I'm like, don't ever do
problems.
All right, we're back on. Back to you, Mr. Cullen.
Thank you, Chair Davidos. Our next item is a study session on the Planning Commission bylaws. And the City Council is now requiring that the bylaws of its boards and commissions will be standardized. The Clerk and City Attorney's Office are here tonight to present what the proposal is for the standardized bylaws for the Planning Commission. This is for information and discussion only tonight. No action is being asked of you. And tonight we have with us again Charmaine Hirodondo, Assistant Director of City Clerk's Office, and Matt McFarlane, Assistant City Attorney with the City Attorney's Office. And I'll turn the floor over to them with your permission.
Good evening, Chair Davidos, Vice Chair Walter, and Council members. I have to say that I'm disappointed there isn't a bigger public turnout for digital transition and bylaw updates.
But summer rating.
I'm glad we didn't rent out the Maiden Bauer Center for this one. As Mr. Cullen mentioned, about 2 years ago in July 2015, the council amended the city code to require that all council-appointed boards and commissions adopt bylaws that are consistent with state law and the city code. And you heard Matt and Jessica mention it during their presentation. It's the Washington State Open Public Meetings Act, the OPM, and they already pointed out, I believe, two sections where the Planning Commission bylaws were not consistent with the state law. And the majority of the sections that are being amended for all of the boards and commissions are not variable. That the goal is that where appropriate to have uniform and consistent bylaws across all of the council-appointed board and commissions. However, the Planning Commission obviously has very specific procedures. You have a very specific important role in city process, particularly the land use process. And one thing that Ms. Arredondo and I will go through tonight are the most important revisions to the bylaws. I'm going to go through about 10 of them. And then we can discuss the changes necessary to make the bylaws consistent with the council's direction with the OPM, the state law. And also, I want to point out at the beginning that you have your own code section in the Bellevue City Code and the BCC. And so these new bylaws, where appropriate, track that BCC code, which is 3.64. And I'll try to point out, kind of as we go through these 10 sections, what BCC code it follows, along with the more standardized version that the council has adopted, and also the requirements of the Open Public Meetings Act. So this is the first time that you guys have seen any of this, and it's in your packet. This might be a good exercise to start off with the iPads, because you can pull up the bylaws and then read them and track them pretty easily. It's in the agenda, and the goal is for us to finalize these for when you get back in September, and then we'll come back at a later meeting for adoption of the bylaws. So if we're last on the agenda item tonight, if we don't kind of come to a consensus and if we just discuss it tonight, I'd strongly encourage everyone to maybe take some more time looking at some of these sections we go through tonight, and then let Mr. Cullen know if there's any kind of issues or suggestions or questions you have, and we can talk about it and try to incorporate it into the finalized version. So I'll start kind of moving chronologically through the bylaws that are included in your packet, and I'm really going to point out some of the changes here with Charmaine, and if you have any questions or comments about it, just feel free to talk about it as we get to the section, because I'll move on to the next section if everybody's on the same page. So the first section is in Article 2, and it's subsection D. And this is one thing that Matt and Jessica had mentioned. It is the quorum issue. And the old bylaws stated that essentially if a quorum is, or the current bylaws, I should say, stated that if a quorum exists at the opening of the meeting, then it's presumed to exist until the meeting is adjourned, even if commissioners were to leave. That's not only inconsistent with the OPM, it's also inconsistent with your own code in the BCC, which is 3.64.030C. So the bylaws in your packet, the updated bylaws, actually track the BCC section and are consistent with the OPM. And what it says is that at all meetings of the commission, quorum consists of a majority of the members, and quorum must be maintained throughout the entirety of the meeting. That's a requirement, but I wanted to just point that out to you guys as a really important amendment here. The second portion of the bylaws that I want to move to is Article 5, Section A, which talks about the time and place of meetings. The current bylaws state that meetings are at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays, which, as you all know, is not correct. So we have amended this so that the regular meeting of the commission shall be at 6:30 on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, unless there's a critical or time-sensitive work, and the commission may recess for either the month of August or December. And regular continued meetings that fall on a holiday shall be rescheduled by the commission. And once again, this tracks your BCC code section, which is 3.64.03A, subsection A. And that's, once again, a correction that actually tracks the law and accurately reflects your true meeting schedule rather than the incorrect one in the bylaws. In the same section, but if you move on to subsection G, I'd like to thank Commissioner Barksdale for actually giving us an example of this, of this amendment, which is remote participation. And I believe that Matt and Jessica mentioned this as well, that the updated bylaws in your packet will track the BCC 3.64.030E, and this really provides the accurate explanation according to our local code of what is the parameters and the requirements for remote participation. Your former bylaws did not have any comment about this. It certainly applied to the commission because it was in the code, but now we're memorializing that portion of the code into the bylaws as well.
Awesome.
And then subsection J of Article 5 as well. This has to do with adjournment. If you look at it in your packet, we've left that time for adjournment blank. The current bylaws state that after 11 p.m. there'll be no new business heard without a majority vote of the commissioners. There is no BCC code section in the Planning Commission section that it specifically addresses adjournment, so you certainly have an option here. This is one of the variable sections where you can put in an adjournment time if you'd like to. You can also have language in there that speaks to the extension of the time if the majority of the members are present and vote to extend the time. But this Article 5, subsection J, is really up to you. You know your meetings better than anyone else does, and so that's a decision that you can make at any point in time. If you want to discuss it tonight, we can. If not, we can try to settle on a time at a later date and incorporate it into the finalized bylaws.
Chair Davidoff.
I do just have one question about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can make it relative to, say, as designated, like, per the agenda, right? So, like, it gives some flexibility, but then it's... The key thing is that it's made known to everyone in advance of the meeting.
That's certainly the idea, would be to have an end time. The city council, obviously, their meetings are from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Every Monday. They do have the option, just like you would have the option, if you put an end time, if you decided that end time was 10 o'clock, if you decided it was 11 o'clock, whatever it was, if your particular business on that evening took you beyond that and a majority vote of the commissioners wanted to extend the meeting, you could. It certainly wouldn't limit you from doing that.
It's really kind of, the idea is to track, to when it's practical, to track the same process the council has on these broader kind of issues of how we're going to conduct our meeting. That's not going to work across the board because, like I said at the beginning, the commission has a different role, and the commission is a different fact-finding body. But this would be one of those subsections in which, if you set a definite time and then left yourself the option to extend it as needed with a majority vote, you would be tracking the council procedures.
And that would be our recommendation, that you would do that. Otherwise, you may have endless meetings that go to any particular hour of the morning, even.
If I could, Chair Davis, this is the first time, in all the jurisdictions I've worked, I've never seen an end time before. So that, I'm curious about that. Is it required, or is it just to match the policy that council has established? I mean, the order of business typically is if you're given the amount of business that's put on your agenda, the expectation is, unless there's something unusual, you're going to conduct and take action on all the matters at hand. Whether it be 9:30, 10 o'clock. Last year on the Newport Hills Plan Amendment, I believe we had one meeting where we extended the meeting at least three times because we kept running up against this, well, the bylaws say that we have an end time. And at that time, I think we were all wondering, why do we need to have an end time? But I'll just throw that out there for thought.
Well, the end time certainly can be extended. I mean, council does that all the time. You see meetings that run over, and they agree as a majority to extend the time past what the end time normally would be. There's certainly an advantage to having that end time, but also having the flexibility to extend it, because you do have a kind of deadline to get through your business. I would say that Planning Commission meetings do have far more public hearing function, where it can extend further, and we'll get to that also when we talk about some of the public hearing and public meeting aspects of the bylaws. And like I said, we don't have to make a decision tonight, but Charmaine and I wanted to let everybody know that it's currently 11. The council procedure and the recommendation is to kind of pick a time that you think is appropriate, or keep the 11 o'clock time, but certainly you would have the authority to extend that meeting if needed by a majority.
If I could, one more, Chair Davidos. The last year was very unusual, perhaps, for the Planning Commission for the amount of business that they took care of. We had meetings that we started at 4:30, and now you've got, you start at 6:30. And we've tried different ways to actually extend the amount of meeting time so that it works within reasonable hours, just because the volume of business was so great. We may need if you're insistent on an end time, we'll definitely need flexibility, and may need flexibility on the start time if the commission agrees that perhaps something should be started earlier.
You certainly have the flexibility to start earlier. You have that flexibility now. You have to notice it as a special meeting to start anything earlier than your regularly scheduled time. So you always have that flexibility, but I will say too that you do currently have an end time to your agenda, and it is 11 o'clock because the bylaws do currently state that no new business will occur after 11 without a majority vote. So if you did have that end time, that certainly wouldn't be inconsistent with what you have right now. It would just be perhaps worded a little bit differently.
So I have a question in terms of, so say we put in the bylaws at the end time is, I don't know, 10 o'clock, and we are at 9 o'clock. Are we in any way sort of obligated to continue on to 10 o'clock, or?
No, absolutely not. The meeting ends when business is over. The meeting adjourns.
Okay.
And again, if you do have an end time and you want to extend that, there is no set rule for the amount of time you can extend. You know, the council frequently extends for 10 minutes at a time, hoping that they are able to get through that particular last item in a short period of time. But there's nothing saying you couldn't extend the meeting for a full hour at a time to avoid that multiple extension.
And if we say that, so then if we put an earlier time than the end time, so if we put an earlier time on the agenda than the end time in the bylaws, we don't have to take a motion if we go over the agenda end time.
I'm sorry, did you say you don't have to make a motion to end earlier? Is that what you asked?
No. So say like on the agenda we're slated to end at, I don't know, 8, right? But we go over the designated end time on the agenda. We just keep going. We don't need to make a motion because we're not at the, say, 10 p.m. end time according to the bylaws.
Whatever the end time on your bylaws is, that is when you would have to make a motion to extend. You would have to do that prior to that end time. So if your end time is 10 o'clock, at 9:55 you realize you have 2 items of business left, someone needs to make a motion to extend for a specific period of time. So, you know, Vice Chair Walton makes a motion to extend for half an hour to extend to 10:30, and then that's carried by a majority vote. Then you go until 10:30, and that process repeats, and you can have multiple extensions beyond that.
Yeah, so the end time on the agenda is irrelevant. So if we say we plan to end at 9 and we go past 9 and the bylaws state that we make a motion after 10 p.m., and if we go past 9, we don't need to make a motion. It's only if
no,
we go after 10.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm sorry, I misunderstood. So I didn't know until just recently that the Planning Commission actually has, that you actually publish times on your agenda, specific item times, so that, like, for instance, this evening's agenda looks like it would, well, actually, he had his programmed all the way through to 10 o'clock, but I did misunderstand that. So, yes, if your end time was 10 o'clock, but the agenda, the printed agenda, said you were going to end at 9, you could end at 9, or you could go beyond 9 and not have to make that motion.
I will say that brings up a good point just as a practical matter for discussion, is that having the time periods on your agenda certainly does kind of keep people mindful of how long they have. I think you saw it when Matt and Jessica said we can keep our presentation to 30 minutes. The end time does that as well. I mean, the commissioners and public or anyone, staff, if they're giving a presentation, will be mindful of when the meeting is supposed to end, if it has an end time. And that's certainly not a requirement by any stretch of the imagination, but it's one of the kind of it guides the meeting to a certain extent, yeah,
and allows you a certain amount of protection,
right?
From it being
interminable
meeting.
Yes. Right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The next section is D and E in Article 6. And this, I believe Mr. Cullen already referenced this when we were going through the iPads, or maybe Charmaine did, but the order of business that's highlighted in the bylaws packet, this tracks the Legistar order of business. One of the changes, for example, is that public comment is now called oral and written communications, which is form and not substance. It's still the same public comment, but the idea is to track the actual system that the city is using, particularly now that you're going through the digital transition as well, and the goal is to have the order of business that is the standardized version of it track what's going to be on the server. With E, this is a important amendment. If you look at Article 6E, it talks about when the agenda may be modified, supplemented, or revised by a majority affirmative vote of the commission members present. The current bylaws state that the agenda may be modified, supplemented, or revised by a unanimous vote. And this is consistent with the state law, which is that it only requires a majority vote, and also is just less onerous if you want to change the agenda. You don't need everyone to agree. You only need a majority of people to agree.
Tell me again why we changed the term public comment to oral communication.
That's consistent with the way it is noted at City Council. Their topic is oral and written communications and then continued oral communications. So you receive public comment in two ways. You receive it orally by people coming and speaking, and in written form by people sending emails or providing written comment at the meeting itself.
I'm just wondering why they felt the need to change that. Something so clinical and sterile.
It wasn't a change. The change is here at the commission level. That is just to fall in line with the way our city council refers to public comment.
Could we not change it the other direction? I mean, I think what John is getting, the point that he's getting to is that, you know, we want to make sure we're writing in plain language, right? No,
yeah, we could do it later, but yeah, that just, you know, it's like we're holding our meetings in a dental office.
and the order of this agenda, other than kind of the requirements, right, that you have a call to order and a roll call at the beginning of the meeting and approval of agenda, these are legal requirements, but otherwise, once again, you guys know the way that you conduct your meetings. You know, certainly we want to try to be consistent as best we can across the different boards and agencies, but it's something to look at and provide feedback on as well, just like the redesignation of oral communication or public comment as oral communications.
And not to be pedantic, but we have had other communications as well. We can do waving of the arms and so on in terms of public comment. So this is very clinical about two very specific channels, right? Mm-hmm.
That's true. The shaking of the
exactly.
hands. Correct. So 6 and 7 are kind of a pair, and this is very, this is probably the most important two issues for all of the commissioners to review and discuss and decide eventually how we want to codify this in the bylaws. Article 7C and Article 7D, these both go to public hearings, and what will be referred to in these bylaws is oral communications, because this is a non-variable D section. But what C is similar to the current bylaws with changes. D is more of tracking what council has in their bylaws and procedures. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you have your own unique function. The Planning Commission has its own unique function. One of the public hearing testimony changes that are in this current bylaw is it's 3 minutes per speaker. Applicants for privately initiated comp plan amendments are allowed 15 minutes for testimony. That's consistent with the current bylaws. We also have a statement that we encourage the speakers to indicate support or opposition rather than just repeat testimony, which I think is a very good change. And there's no specific time limit on the length of the hearing, other than, the potential end time for the Planning Commission meeting. This is, you know, specifically the 3 minutes per speaker, that's how long council has. This is something the commission would really want to eyeball and decide if that is appropriate for the meetings and the public hearings that the commission is conducting. You're certainly a fact-gathering commission that conducts a lot of public hearings on very contentious land use issues, and that may be one of the areas where you want to potentially expand the time limit for public communications. It could serve your mission better than the 3 minutes that council has, which I think appropriately serves their mission. With oral communications, council has in their procedure that it shall not exceed 30 minutes. You certainly would have flexibility regarding the 30 minutes or the 3 minutes per person, which is also in Article 7D. And the good news with both of these subsections, Articles 7C and D, going to the public hearings and public comments / oral communications, is that there is no BCC code section that tells you what you should do here. So it's really up to the commission to decide what works best for satisfying your role, taking the public comment that you need to consider when making a recommendation, and also within reason for the type of meetings that you'd like to conduct that don't go from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m.
Chair Davidis. The following up from the retreat that we had last November, there were two things that were a follow-up from that retreat, which I was hoping we were going to be able to get into at least in the first quarter one or quarter two of this year, but downtown livability took up your entire agenda. One was you deferred any action on public comment and how to address public comment. So it's now being called into question as part of your bylaws. So let's plan to have a robust discussion about that maybe in September. Yeah. The other part of it was that the idea that we were going to sit down as a group and have a discussion about guiding principles, and Commissioner Morisseau had brought that up, and I haven't forgotten. So the guiding principles actually may influence how you decide you want to approach your public comment and addressing working with the public. So we might want to try to weave that in if that's possible. Now, right now, September is looking like it's going to be a quiet month. That's right now. I don't know what it'll be like when we get closer to it, but if it stays that way, I think it would be appropriate to try to include that in as part of the conversation.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to mention that?
Just to mention, the one thing that is in the code that you don't have the ability to or the flexibility to change is the 15 minutes allowed in total for any privately initiated comp plan amendments.
Right.
So proponents for those do get those 15 minutes in total, and there is no flexibility there.
That's correct. That's an issue that comes up at the Planning Commission meetings. I will reiterate that these are the two sections that I think would require the most input from perhaps the Planning Commission even more so than other boards and commissions,
yeah.
But because of your unique role and because of the fact that you conduct these massive public hearings that require and encourage and your recommendations based on the comments that you get during those hearings.
Will you be here when we go over it in September? Because I'm not necessarily going to remember what you said we could and couldn't change. I think that would just make it easier so that we don't ask for a change
sure.
and then have to be told we can't make it.
And I would say certainly if you, once again, since you've just recently got these, if you read through the entire, I'm highlighting kind of the big important things mm-hmm. that are either variable or something that I'm trying to draw your attention to. If I am not mentioning it within these 10 sections that we're talking tonight, it's pretty much set in stone. I mean, it's going to be the same for every board and commission, but when you read it, you'll find that it doesn't really have a lot to do with procedures or protocol. It's just the standard kind of boards and commission bylaw language.
Okay.
But if you read it between now and when we come back in September, and we'll be here in September to talk about it too. But you can certainly forward questions or comments over to Terry, and we can let you know, oh, that's something that, yes, we should talk about it, or no, that's going to be the same for every board and commission. So we could answer that question informally even before we get back, if that comes up while you're reviewing it as well. This next section, which is Article 10, has to do with ethics, and this is a section that is not variable, but I just wanted to point it out for everybody to read, because this is going to end up tracking the Bellevue City Code 3.64010E, and then also it will comply with the Bellevue Ethics Code, which is 3.92. And this covers the conflict of interest, appearance of fairness, and legal assistance. I'm your attorney, so I'm only doing this for you guys. The other attorneys will be doing it for their clients. Yeah, I'm a land use attorney. I'm not a Public Records Act attorney. I should say that. Fine. So don't come. I'll have to refer your questions regarding your new digital transition to a different attorney. But you know, that the last part talks about issues that come up with city attorney advice, and then this is a comprehensive, consistent statement in Article 10 of the kind of ethics requirements, which you you've had a statement of ethics in your current bylaws, but not one that tracks the appropriate law. And Article 13A, this is one section in which it's called communications with counsel, and the paragraph that's in these bylaws is not variable, but one thing that I wanted to point out to the commissioners is that the Bellevue City Code at 3.64040 has its own statement regarding council communications. And I thought that if you'd like, we can certainly take the language from the code and put it as a second paragraph here. I can read it out to you just so that you can tell what I'm talking about. It's BCC 3.64.040. It's called Council Communications. And it says, formal communications with or feedback to the council shall represent the official majority and or minority opinions of the commission, and not those of individual commissioners. Commission members wishing to express an individual opinion shall provide their comments at the public comment opportunities on the meeting agenda. So that is something that would arguably be appropriate to put into the bylaws, and we certainly could insert that into the finalized bylaws, but it's not in here right now, and that's one thing that Charmaine and I noticed when we were going through the standardized bylaws.
What we did on homeless shelter. Public comments.
And I would like to point out too that your code refers to public comment rather than oral communications. And the last section has to do with records, and this is somewhat repetitive of what we already discussed today, but this is in Article 14. And I won't belabor this point because you already had 30 minutes of public records education. And the key to these two bylaw amendments are Article 14A, subsection A, and Article 14, subsection B. All of these, A through F, are very important now that you've gotten your city email addresses and your city tablet. But this is not something that is variable and can be edited, but I wanted to draw everybody's attention to this public records section, which has been heavily amended from the current bylaws, which Charmaine can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they just say records are available for
viewing.
For viewing, yeah.
Community Development Departments. Back in 1994 was when those bylaws were adopted, and the idea of a record was much smaller than it is now.
So, and so this entire Section 14 is brand new.
Yes.
And very, very important. So that's the reason that I highlighted it to talk about at this meeting. And like I said, we've looked at the calendar and we thought that September, when you come back from recess, might be the best time to kind of get this done. I certainly, as your attorney, would encourage you to adopt these sooner rather than later, given that some of your current bylaws violate state law. But I think that a lot of these new laws accurately reflect and track your own BCC code sections too, which is very important. You certainly are beholden to the code sections, regardless of whether it's in your bylaws or not. But I really like the consistency with the new bylaws and the Planning Commission code sections too.
Okay, so when I look at things, I think everything's editable. Mm-hmm. So to save time for me in September and everybody who has to listen, if you have bubbles out to the side that says which ones match code, so therefore we know they can't be changed, that would be incredibly helpful and probably save a lot of time.
You know what? One thing we could do is we could take the kind of rudimentary chart,
mm-hmm.
and we could point out the variable sections.
Okay.
And then I could also list, just so you could go back and look, pull up the code on the web page and look at the section so you can see what I'm cross-referencing, I could list the code sections that apply to each article of the bylaw where we've talked about it tonight.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And everyone should read the entire bylaws, but just know that a lot of this are the sections that I didn't mention tonight. These are going to be the same for every board and commission.
This is a template that was produced with the idea of rolling this out to all of the boards and commissions.
Right.
So a large majority of it is boilerplate language that applies across the board to all council-appointed boards and commissions.
Right. And like I said, the public meeting, public hearing sections, those are the most important for the commission. And arguably, the commission probably has more flexibility to address those just because of your unique role, too.
Thank you. So I think we just passed the time in terms of our allocation. So unless there are other questions, I would like to suggest we move. Yes.
I have one question, but it's more related to the digital transition, and since Charmaine is still with us. As I was reading through the bylaws, there were a lot of references to the Washington State law or the Bellevue City Code.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we're going to digital, is it possible to have hyperlink to those specific sections of the...
Absolutely. We could certainly... Yeah, let me think through that and see what would be the easiest way to do that, whether that's actually pushing something to the iPad or whether it's just giving you links in your Safari so that you can open Safari and link directly to the code.
Okay.
Through our website. So let me think through that, but I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Thank you. So on that note, then...
One last note, please, yeah. Chair Davidos. Our first meeting in September, September 13th, so we'll look at targeting further discussion on this on September 15th.
And I'll create the kind of chart so that everybody can kind of track the sections we went through tonight and also go back and look at the code sections as well. And Vice Chair Walter, I will flag, since some of the sections I talked about tonight are not variable, but I just wanted to highlight them for you. I'll make that clear as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you for having me.
Let us know if you have any questions again with the transition or any of that.
So I won't ask it now, but I'll be contacting you later about the comprehensive plan amendment criteria.
Okay.
So it's well past midnight for you, Mr. Barksdale. So anyway. Moving on. So the next item on the agenda is our elections. So we typically have them the last meeting of June. I believe we did not do this at the last meeting. I think, is it because we don't have the meeting, or is it because we...
The Bellevue Technology Center plan amendment, which was the main subject for the study session, was withdrawn, and there was no purpose
there was
behind
no
it.
Right. Thank you. So the process we had last time was we had the elections towards the end of June. August typically is our summer break, and so the new officers would basically start beginning with the September meetings. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what we would follow this time. We have one more meeting for the PC in July, which is 2 weeks from now. So just want to pause. Any questions, comments about the process? Maybe Mr. Cullen could clarify the process for us as well, if you like.
Yes, please. I'm going to ask the Planning Commission to affirm the process first and then proceed with your elections. And per the agenda memo that went out and just as stated for the record here, it will start off, the chair will ask for nominations. A second is not required for a nomination. After that has been exhausted, the chair will close the nominations, and a motion to close is not required. If there is only one nominee, the chair will simply declare the nominee elected. If there is more than one nominee, the chair will call for a separate vote for each nominee. Voting is done with a voice vote by each individual commissioner. And the election is declared final when one nominee receives the majority of votes. If no nominee receives a majority of votes after the first round of voting, then successive rounds of voting are conducted until one candidate receives a majority of the votes. And the elections process for, there's two positions that are being up for election, the chair and the vice chair. The elections process is concluded for each one of the positions once the two positions have been elected. I think I said that correctly. So that's the process, and if the Planning Commission agrees with it, I'd like you to just make a motion to affirm the process so that we have on the record we're following, all following the standardized process. And that actually, I think, comes from the bylaws, and then we can proceed with the elections.
Do we have a motion to affirm the process?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes, so... I think moving into the process then, I will ask for nominations for the role of chair.
Well, I will nominate current vice chair, Stephanie Walters.
I second that. Mm-hmm.
Do we have any other nominations? So, barring other nominations, Vice Chair Walter, you are the new chair.
Excellent. So you'll sit right beside me, yes?
I will do my best to try to help, if not to... moving on to the Vice Chair role, so do we have nominations for the Vice Chair?
I would like to nominate Commissioner Boxdale to be the Vice Chair.
We have a nomination. Do we have any other nominations?
I just second the nomination, but okay.
Barring other nominations, I believe Commissioner Barksdale, you are our new vice chair.
Are you right? Are you here, Jeremy?
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
From 3,000 miles away.
Okay. That was fairly straightforward and fairly easy. Thank you. So is there anything formally we should do, Mr. Cullen, in terms of...
Nope, that concludes this agenda item. Congratulations for such a smooth election process. I applaud you on that.
Thank you. So we have one last item for this evening, which is the minutes. I believe we have two to review. Now, I was not present for the May 10th session, so I will have to... But if there are other comments or questions. If not, do we have a motion to approve the minutes of May 10th?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I was wondering there for a second.
Sorry.
Thank you. So I believe the motion passes. We have the May 10th minutes approved. We also have the minutes for May 24th.
I have a couple.
I move that we pass the May 24th meeting minutes.
I believe we have one question here, so if you would just hold on, Commissioner Burstow.
I have a couple of comments. On page 15 mm-hmm. of the minutes, last and third paragraph from the bottom, mm-hmm. I would direct staff to go back and listen to the records, because my recollection is that the way I put this is that I was in agreement with Commissioner Walter about the 10%, and I was also in agreement with Commissioner Walter about the park fees. I just didn't necessarily agree that the motion should have both of them together in one motion. As stated, it's different here.
I'll go back and listen to that, and then I'll talk with you, and you can help me figure out how to get the wording on it correct.
Okay.
All right.
And then my next comment is page 19, paragraph 6, that starts with Commissioner Morso. The end of the paragraph, as stated, implies that staff did not follow through with that legal presentation on the implication mm-hmm. of the legal implications of the amenity incentives. It's just that they never had the time. The agenda just kept being pushed that staff couldn't present the information to us, not that they never followed through. So where it says commission staff on several occasions promised a presentation to the commission but did not follow through.
So how would you like it reworded?
Centrally, that staff never really had the opportunity to present it.
Weren't able to follow through?
Yep. Or were not allocated time.
Yeah.
But weren't allocated sufficient time. Yeah. Boom.
That sounds worse to me.
Yep.
Because who does the time allocation, and why did it get... I think it should be they ran out of time, something
makes
like
sense.
That.
Keep it simple.
That's not like something this time wasn't taken away from them.
Okay.
Keep it simple, yeah. Makes sense.
All right,
so then we'll wait then for the follow-on from this one before we proceed on this.
Well, if you are comfortable with me working out, I'll put that they ran out of time for that one. But the first one, I'll go back and listen to it. And if you're comfortable with me working with Commissioner Morso to just get the rewording on that, you could move ahead with it. Or I could bring the whole set of minutes back to you. Either or would be acceptable.
Either way is fine with me. I can work with Terry and come up with something that would work, if that's okay with the rest of the commission.
Sure. So do we have a motion then to pass the...
Motion to approve the adjustment to the minutes as recommended.
Do we have a second?
Okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. So there we go. All right. So no public comment, obviously. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
There we go.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And just a reminder, I'm really hoping to have all your participation on July the 26th. We're going to do pictures.
Yes.
It'll be the last meeting for our current chair and vice chair.
That's right. Before you leave, please make sure you get the power adapters. I think we
Oh, yes.